I am Karina Freeman, and today I'm chatting with Camilla Caro about gaming, VR, and CX. Camilla currently works as a customer experience, or otherwise known as a CX analyst, for an online betting and gaming company. She's previously worked for a VR reality company running events, training, and leadership development, and has developed and published a gaming in difficult life situations scale and focused her master research on how gaming in difficult life situations can impact well-being. Welcome, Camilla. I'm so delighted to have you on board.
Thank you, Carolyn. I'm happy to be here.
So, Camilla, before we get chatting about your work and the research you've done in your master's, can you tell me a little bit more about your background? So who you are and what the pivot point was that sent you down the road of cyber psychology?
So, well, you pretty much introduced who I am. I am Camilla. I am a cyber psychologist. And, well, the pivot point that drove me into cyber psychology, it was really about like two passions of mine. So I always saw them kind of separate, and they were finally coming together. So on one hand, I loved psychology, and I got into psychology for like personal reasons. I wanted to understand myself better, as I think most of us want to. And on the other hand, I've been an avid gamer my whole life. And like, I always thought, like for the longest time, I thought those were two different worlds. And when I started my undergraduate in psychology, we had a cyber psychology module. And in this cyber psychology module, we have specifically 1 week looking into online gaming. And I was like, oh my God, how could I not fall in love with this? It's online gaming and psychology, like it's all together, it's perfect. So I fell in love with it immediately. The moment I saw that lesson, I was like, this is it. This is what I want to do for the rest of my life. And it also gave me like the chance to explore something that I felt very deeply, which I think many people would think, or they have this view that video games are bad for you. And my experience, my life experience, was the complete opposite. Like, I went through difficult life situations like everyone does in their lives, and video games were the best support channel I had. It was amazing to think that I could combine my passion for gaming while understanding why gaming actually worked for me in those times. And it's not, oh, gaming is bad for you, you're just addicted, it's just a thing to distract yourself from problems, you're not actually solving anything. But in this module, it was like, no, there's actually psychology in games, there's actually something we can look into, games and video games, and why people react like this, why people act like this in video games. And I just fell in love. I mean, I think that's what really sent me on this path of cyber psychology. I wanted to understand more about myself and why video games were so beneficial to me. And, well, they shaped the person I am now.
And I think you're right, is that so many people talk about video games as being, and they reference violent video games. And they reference how these young people sit in front of a screen and they don't get out and they don't play football and they don't go for walks, so they don't engage face to face with people. And so there's an immediate thing of, well, gaming is bad and gaming is isolating and gaming is not great for someone. And so, and you've spoken about how it's really helped you. And there was a bit of research during COVID around how there was a huge increase in gaming, wasn't there? And how people use it to escape and kind of escape from the fear of what was going on around them.
Absolutely. I think that what happened in the pandemic was like a real turning point for gaming. Because before, gaming is like, oh, you need to control how much time your kid is playing, or you need to pay attention of all these games that are making violent people. And then the pandemic happened. And then we see companies are like big corporations going like, oh yeah, you can play video games with your family, with your friends. We're in this together. Let's play more video games. And it was this sudden shift of video games are terrible for you to, oh, now that you're stuck in your house doing absolutely nothing, video games are actually helpful.
Yeah. Have you seen a shift back to that kind of negative mindset, or has that kind of continued to be more, a lot more positive around how good gaming or how helpful gaming can be?
Yeah, I think the view has changed after that. Like, there's a lot of positives during the pandemic where people like fought loneliness with video games, or fought like the boredom. They tried to create a routine during the pandemic with video games. And yes, I think we've noticed in the academic side more articles coming out saying video games are good for this or for that or for whatever. Like, I think more people are focusing more on the good things that video games can give you than video games are bad and they will make you violent and you start just shooting everyone.
Oh, obviously, because if you play any video games, you go buy a gun, don't you?
Yeah, of course. It doesn't matter if you play like Animal Crossing where you're just taking care of an island and beautiful animals. No.
Yeah, it's fine. No, it's just all synonymous. Because you and I both studied our masters at Buckingham University together. Well, you were just in a similar kind of time scale and with Masha Popovic, who is just amazing and brilliant. But you're based in Colombia. So why did you kind of study at Buckingham? You did your undergrad there as well, didn't you?
Yes, I did my undergrad in there. Basically, because, well, I didn't know I wanted to study psychology the moment I left school. I did other things before studying psychology. I went into chemical engineering. I studied chemistry. I studied photography. I got my pilot's license. I did a lot of things before I decided to study psychology. Yes. And in Colombia, psychology as an undergraduate takes 5 years.
Oh, wow.
And in the UK, specifically in Buckingham, it takes 2 years. 2 years on some change in some cases. So I was like, well, I'm already a mature student at that point. I didn't want to like start a new career from scratch. Like 5 years seemed like a lot. So I was like, let's go study psychology in Buckingham. It's shorter. And in there, as I was saying before, I ran into the psychology module and was like, this is amazing. Like, I just gonna do a master's in this. This is what I really want to study. So I stayed in Buckingham and did my cyberpsychology master's.
And the focus of your research for your undergrad dissertation was around gaming and well-being, which we've kind of mentioned already. So what got you interested in understanding the correlation between gaming and well-being? Because you kind of touched on it, but what there must have been something specific about that that's kind of excited you and also where you built this measure that has now been published.
That's true. So as I mentioned before, it was all about gaming and psychology. I think the worst time in my life, like the worst difficult experience I had to do in my life was going through grief. Almost 9 years ago, my father passed away and it was very sudden. It was a month and a half. Like I found out he was sick one day and month and a half, he was gone.
Oh, wow.
Sorry about that. It was awful. Thank you. Yeah. It was rough. And I was 24 at the time. I was still very young, very kind of crazy, would call it like that. So it was kind of like a wake up call. Like, oh, wow, this is happening. I felt really alone. I don't have any brothers or sisters to help me with this type of grief. And my cousins are older than me. They haven't experienced this. It was completely, completely isolating. And I just didn't know who to talk. Of course, well, my mom was going through her own grief. But I went into video games. Video games were it was like a lighthouse. So I started playing this game called Destiny. Destiny is an online game. Yes, you can play it alone, but you would enjoy it more with a team. And you had activities that were from 3 people up to 6 people. And I had my friends from Destiny, just gaming friends that we just hang out every now and again. And when that happened, I didn't want to do anything else besides gaming. And they understood, like I told them, this is what I want to do. This is what happened. Let's just play a video game. And they helped me so much. And
oh, wow.
I know it wasn't just a game on itself. It was the support I have from my gaming people. And it was people I've never met before. Like, I never knew them in real life. I just only met them through this game. And they would, like, give me tasks. Like, okay, Camila, you're gonna carry the flag because whatever. Something to make me feel important and kind of get me out of my ruminating feelings. And I think that if I hadn't had that support or that gaming space, I probably would still be dealing with that grief way worse. So after that, after all that happened, I went to study psychology. And I was like, why was this so helpful to me in this bad, bad time? Like, I didn't want to do anything else. And some people might have seen it as a very destructive type of coping mechanism because I wasn't doing much besides gaming. But it was the way it helped me. It was the way it allowed me to speak about it. Because it was not just, oh, I'm just gaming, I'm forgetting about this. I'm talking about what's going on with my friends. Or the people that I consider friends, even if I've never met them.
Yeah.
And I think it was that. It was, why something that is seen as so bad and so addicting and you're just losing your time was actually so impactful in taking me out of this hole and this void. So for the undergrad, I was like, yes, let's do research into video games specifically during difficult life situations. Like, what drove us? What is helpful about them? Or what could be too bad if you use gaming as a coping mechanism? Because, of course, there's always extremes with everything you use.
In your kind of research, you talk about hedonic well-being and eudaimonic. I don't know how to pronounce it, well-being.
Eudaimonic. Yeah. I struggle as well.
It's a complicated word. But what is the difference between them and kind of why does it matter when it comes to gaming?
The difference between hedonic and eudaimonic, that's a big one. This is the research I focus more on my master's. And so well-being, we know well-being is just like your general, I don't know, comfort, like you're feeling okay with yourself. And there's different types of well-being, in this case, hedonic and eudaimonic. There's also others that I didn't mention in my research, like spiritual, familiar, all of that. In this case, hedonic and eudaimonic are like the biggest branches, so to speak. Hedonic is what we often think as happiness. It's based on seeking pleasure while avoiding pain right now. So it's pretty much striving for positive feelings or satisfaction with life. It's what gives you happiness right now. While eudaimonic, it's a bit deeper. It's not just about feeling good right now. It's about personal growth. It's about kind of like realizing your potential and finding a sense of meaning and purpose in your life. And it's more closely related to self-actualization. In eudaimonic well-being, it's more like, oh, let's say I go to the gym. I'm not happy going to the gym. I'm not happy having to go out raining and cold and sweating. It's not fun at that moment. But I know that I'm working for something in the future, that I'm going to have a better body, better health. Like, it's going to make me better to what I want to be. So it's kind of like pushing through the rough times right now for something better in the future.
Okay, that makes sense. And because a number of times people talk about kind of current happiness and how happy I feel right now, and that's a determination of future happiness. It's just kind of a momentary joy. And I often talk about joy is not the same as contentment, a kind of life contentment. And I wonder if that's a similar thing, is that hedonic is kind of a fleeting feeling and eudaimonic is more of a lifetime of pushing, as you say, pushing through the pain and pushing through the tough times to build something that's so much better. And it's almost like, I guess, in a way, to when you're building a skill that you become really good at, it's pushing through all the tough times when you're building that skill and it's really hard, but you get to a point when the flow happens and you're really good at it.
Yes, exactly. So that's like the eudaimonic, although hedonic could also lead to something good in the future. Like you can do, I don't know, smoke a cigarette. Well, that's probably a bad example. But yeah, it gives you joy right now. It's probably going to kill you in a couple of years, but it's calming you now. Okay, if we look at it as the gaming part, because usually gaming is seen as hedonic. It's just a hedonic activity. It's your stress. You're going to play some Xbox for fun, pleasure right now, or escape right now. And that is, I'm not saying it's not true. It is accurate. But sometimes video games can also give you some eudaimonic benefits and build things for the future.
Like working for a VR company,
for instance.
Which brings me to the point of kind of, you and I both actually worked for a VR, and we worked, especially during the pandemic, when we're doing some training with companies. So kind of what are the things that you learned in that? Or what is your role within the company, and kind of what are the big learnings really you got from your time there?
My time there was amazing. I actually loved it. I think that when you and I studied cyber psychology wasn't much in the world at all. Yeah. So it was always, what am I going to do with this knowledge that I'm putting so much effort into? But going into VR and realizing that I can actually use this knowledge, that I'm actually using what I learned, it's amazing. And in VR, I noticed, still VR, it's seen as a clunky thing. Like you need very heavy equipment. It's not super clear or detailed. And it's not really analyzed because it's still in its infancy, so to speak. But working in this environment was seeing how, yes, people are acting different online, but they're acting completely different when they're in VR. Like, it's like the next step. We know that people behave different online and all that thing with Sutton. But in VR, the social, the online disinhibition is insane. They completely forget that they are in an online world. And you see people, like, they forget how you act with people in real life. Like, they don't respect kind of your social space. You see people very close to you and you're like, you wouldn't be standing this close to me if we were in real life. What is about VR that is making you this type of annoying? Or they just start like putting their hands inside of your hand, of your face, and it's like, no, this is still space.
Exactly.
It was really fun to see it, like, the extreme of the online disinhibition.
And also what was really fascinating in some ways quite fun is seeing people who are new to VR, and you got to experience the real newness because you got to train them, and that before we actually went into training, you did the orientation processes with them. But when we did the training, they spent the first half hour just kind of playing because it was such a new environment. And they got up to things that you kind of go, you wouldn't do this in a real world scenario. You wouldn't be in a meeting room drawing big bunny rabbits in the sky bubble guns.
Exactly. Yes. Just
come on.
Shooting confetti at people. It's like, we are in a meeting right now. This is a training.
This is professional training. Your company's paying you for you to be here.
Yes.
But they as you say, they completely lose the disinhibition of real life. And what I found really interesting as well during that time is that you kind of almost got their full focus because they didn't have all that outside a distraction of people walking past the meeting room and other people playing with stuff and them looking at what the other people are doing. Once they kind of calmed down into space, they're really just focused and they seem to get so much more from the experience than they would otherwise.
I think so, yes. I think the immersion was really great, and it showed that it was much more effective than like having Zoom trainings or Google Meet trainings. And it was, people would just put on the headset, they forget what time it was. And it was funny sometimes, like, okay, guys, it's time for a break. And they would remove the headsets and they're like, oh my God, it's been an hour and I didn't even realize I've been training for an hour. And it was really fun, yeah.
So what are the, because there are other things that you did outside of ISR training that I was involved in, because there was also some other gaming stuff that was involved in the kind of business environment. What are those kind of things that you got involved in?
Oh, yeah. So besides the trainings and the soft skills that you've seen and given, actually, we did the escape rooms. So, well, the escape rooms were not only team bonding experiences, but it was also to see, assess leadership or assess certain specific skills that a company would like to assess. So it was, I will have to observe how the participants navigated this virtual challenges. So let's say we have escape room and they have to open up a gate. So they have to find the key, but they have to communicate as in real life escape room, they have to work as a team. And you'll see in VR, some people will just stop talking. I couldn't figure out how to pick up this flashlight, so I'm just going to let the others do their thing. And it was just noticing this, trying to help people, like, okay, are you struggling with the test that we're assigning you? Are you struggling with the controllers themselves? Like, is it the VR that is the problem, or is it the actual skills that we want to test here? And, well, it was really fun. The funnest part of that was all usually at the end when we used to play paintball with the clients. And so after all the training, after they've been solving all these puzzles, like, there are some really difficult puzzles, you know that.
Yeah.
We were like, all right, let's just do some paintball. And people think paintball is just for fun. They're just, this is the stressing part of it. But we're still paying attention to how they communicate in their team. Like, do they say if they see someone walking? Do they call their kills? Do they kind of stop and think if they rush into or just stop? Like, it was a lot of behaviors that VR allowed us to see that you couldn't see, like, in a Zoom meeting or type of puzzle, yeah, like that.
Yeah, and that's one of the things that we kind of we talk to clients about generally is that when you're trying to do scenarios in real life, people kind of counterbalance the fact that they know they're being watched while you're in real life, so they change the behavior. But in VR, it's almost as though their real behavior comes out because they don't, and they lose all inhibition. And one of the things that I noticed, there was a couple of people who just went off and did their own thing. They kind of went and solved the puzzle without actually involving anyone else in the team. And you're kind of going, hold on, there's like five people behind you that are still trying to struggle with things. And you've gone off and try and solve it yourself. Like, come back. Come back.
Yes. Come back. Yeah. We will make a note like, okay, not a team player.
But they all sit, they're so focused on their own self and trying to achieve something and showcase that they're so brilliant, that they forget there's other people behind them. And it's something that they might not necessarily have done if it was in a real world physical space, because they'd be very conscious of the fact that other people, that they've been watched, because they can see, but yes, you can't see people watching you when your vision is a bit blurred.
Yes, exactly. I think that really helps, because you're doing what you're doing. Yes, you see us, but you see us just as I'm just helping.
One of the things is, because I got really ill in VR, I really struggled with motion sickness. It's to the point that I couldn't do kind of the walking things in cigarette, because I'd done it so many times and got ill so many times that I'd literally enter the cigarette thing and go, okay, I'm feeling ill. I haven't moved, but I'm feeling ill.
The moment it loads, you're like, I'm out.
Yes, I'm done. I'm out of here. So, but there's not very many people who do experience motion sickness in VR, is there? It's just I'm a real anomaly.
I haven't done any research about this, but from what I've seen, maybe 30% of people are kind of dizzy in VR. And it's funny because the solution to that is just more VR. It's working on your VR legs. That's the only way.
Exposure therapy, isn't it?
It is exposure therapy. So, you know, Chelsea, she worked with VRE. She still works with VRE.
Yeah.
Chelsea was super VR sick when she started. She couldn't help with the events. Like, she was just doing technical support because she was very, very VR dizzy. But now it's been a couple of years after, and now she's great. She puts on her headset, starts shooting everyone in paintball as if it was nothing. And you wouldn't think that at some point she was dizzy.
I think that was my thing I never pushed through. I was like, no. I'm done. I don't want to be ill.
Because it's the thing. If you're in VR and you're feeling sick, you need to stop. You need to stop. If you push through, it's going to make you way worse.
Oh, yeah.
But so you need to stop and then try a little bit longer and then try a bit longer. But if you keep going on the same kind of session, it's rough.
Yeah, I think that was my error, is that I kept on going because I wanted to feel like a hero, that I'm in this. I can do this. And I just, after that, I lied down for 2 hours, like, I can't move my head. Oh, I feel ill. Mark, yes. No, I can't do this anymore. Oh, that was
cool. We weren't the only one. But yeah, we had some people that we were training to be facilitators, and I was training them, and I was like, okay, I don't want to push through because it's the first training. And they're like, no, let's do it. Let's do paintball. Let's do everything. They couldn't move for the rest of the day. And like, I told you, you need to pace yourself. You need to create the VR legs, but you don't learn to swim an ocean in one day. You need to take it slow.
That's a good point you have there. Cool. And I want to go get back to gaming, because I've realized there's a couple of things that I didn't quite ask you. And you may have answered these already, but you've kind of spoken about the insights from your research, which is awesome. And you've also spoken about the negatives of gaming, but could you tell me a bit more about some of the positives outside of kind of an escape from reality or kind of trying to, or building friendships? What are the other positives?
I love talking about the positives for gaming because as you say, we often hear about the negatives.
Yeah.
And there are so many positives. It's not only about the coping mechanisms, as I was saying, it's not only about the escapes. The positives of gaming, I think we could divide it into like different stages. There are cognitive benefits, there are emotional benefits. Let's start with the cognitive benefits. So this is just about how games make us, or not make us, they sharpen our minds. They make our minds better at what they do. So this is the direct impact on our thinking skills. So we know there's research showing how action games can improve attention allocation and how puzzle games develop problem-solving skills. We also have studies showing that regular gaming show enhanced cognitive skills compared to non-gamers. So it's like a workout for your brain without actually needing like, oh, let's do this Sudoku or this puzzles. This is more interactive type of puzzles that make you think outside of the box. So it kind of, it works on your cognitive flexibility. It's your switch. It's your ability to switch between different tasks. And it's a super important skill because we use it every single day in our daily lives. And games are really good because we have our task on one side. We have side task. We need to organize this consumables for X task. It's very organized in that way. So it's very good for your cognitive abilities. Other benefits, the social benefits, as I was saying, it's just playing with people. It's always better than playing alone. I'm not saying that to discourage the single players or anything, but if you are playing with people, that social connection, even if it's just virtual friends, as many people call them, it helps you like create bonds and experience how these bonds can evolve into other things. So let's say like cooperative games where you are using a team, you're building teamwork, you're building communication skills. You need to complete a raid, for instance, and everyone has their task, everyone has their role, but we need to communicate to say, hey, role one is done, role two is done. It kind of helps you be more supportive to other people. Oh, that's the way I've seen it. And I think I mentioned the emotional benefits. So the emotional benefits are, this is the area that I love the most. This is the most passionate I am. Because it's not just about, it goes beyond games just being fun. Like, yes, games can be a powerful tool for emotional regulation. But as I was saying, they can foster like a sense of deep sense of purpose, like this eudaimonic sense of purpose that we were talking. They can help you grow in your personal experiences. They can help you build resilience. Like, games are great for building resilience because you start a level, you're not going to be able to finish it right away. You need to figure out how to kill this boss, how to finish this level. It's something that it exposes you to a lot of failure, I think. So gamers are exposed to a lot of game over. You lose, you die, and it's like, okay, let's just try again.
It's like it's a resilience and grit and perseverance and just kind of trying to figure out the next or another way to do this. It's kind of a thinking of differences and different ways of doing things and being a bit strategic and trying to figure out the puzzle.
Exactly. And kind of like fosters a growth mindset. I cannot be stuck in this fossil. What the heck?
Yeah. The persistence is I'm going to do this and resolution of I'm not going to let this get on top of me. I'm not going to give up. I'm just going to keep going and I'll make sure I figure out how to do this. And also an element of memory, I guess, because you have to remember what you did the previous time and then work out the steps or kind of go through the steps systematically of how you could do it differently and how to do it better.
Yeah. It's a lot of trial and error. Like, okay, I'm going to try this gun or this sword against this enemy, but this enemy killed me. Okay, last time I tried this, let's try this other power or like magic or anything.
You're going to build those neural pathways that you wouldn't necessarily be exposed to in kind of real world scenarios of, say, if you're playing football, yes, there will be some of it, but it's a very different type of skill set as well. That there's a lot of things that you would never be exposed to in a standard face-to-face in-person game, which can be really positive for personal growth, really.
Yeah, it's exactly. It asks you to persist through failure and to persist when you're frustrated. And you're like, okay, I'll do this, which is a great skill for real life.
Yes, it's a great skill for real life. What a great reason to play games. Parents are often concerned about the amount of time that their children spend gaming because they have this perspective of gaming can be addictive and they're worried about, especially multiplayer online games, about their children being groomed and who they're exposed to and what if they meet someone in the offline world that sort of in an online space that is kind of not all that great. So the first question I have is there kind of a cutoff, a time allowance that parents should potentially give their children to play a game? And the second question is, do you have any specific advice for parents around children, especially, let's say, young teens who are playing video games, especially multiplayer online games?
Okay, yes. So that parent concern, I get it. The media panic of video games are bad, video games will make your child brain rot or be violent. But I don't think it's like a one size fit all. I don't think like, okay, video games should only be played for 2 hours a day. I don't think it's as easy as that. Like, I think it's a very important topic, but it's less about being concerned to more like being aware and engaged. So it's less about the parent going, oh, my kid is playing too much. It's more about like, what are they playing? Who are they playing with? So it's beyond a simple cutoff time, because it doesn't matter about the quantity. It's more about the quality and the context of the gameplay. So in that case, if parents are concerned, but if parents are like, okay, is my child getting enough sleep? Are they finishing their homework? Are they keeping up with school? Are they spending time with friends? Are they spending time with family? If the answer to the questions is yes, then the specific time they're playing, it doesn't matter. It's less of an issue than their overall life balance.
Yeah.
If that balance is there, that can be to how long that we can change that conversation to from how long they're playing to what are they playing. So, you know, movies have their ratings. Some are up for over 7, over 18, over blah, blah, blah. Games have the same thing.
Yeah.
So games have the PG ratings. And I don't think a lot of parents are aware that video games have ratings, that it like, just like movies, the video games have a specific cutoff into which they are acceptable for a kid to play. They are on every game box. They're on the digital store. They will tell you if a game is appropriate for a certain age. And more importantly, it will tell you why. So if it has violence, it would say it has violence. It has foul language. It has all of these things that people could just take 30 seconds to check the rating. That's the most effective thing a parent can do. Like, it doesn't matter if they're playing 30 hours. If it's an appropriate game, if it's a 7-year-old playing Animal Crossing, that's fine. But if it's a 7-year-old playing, I don't know, Battlefield, maybe not.
Not so okay.
Not so okay. The ratings exist for a reason. For your second question, well, yeah, the who are they playing with? The who are they playing with is the most important. We've discussed gaming is incredibly social activity. And like for many kids now, it's how they spend their time. Like that's how they hang out with their friends. And playing with friends can be wonderful if it's a cooperative game, if it's a pro-social activity. We were just mentioning the benefits. If they play with their parents, even better. It's a fantastic approach to like connect with their kids. And there's actually research showing that parents that play with their kids bond better. Like they open up to more conversation, and it helps the parent to understand the world that the child is seeing. So it's about talking to them, like, who are you playing with? Making sure that they're talking, if they're talking online, they're talking to age-appropriate people. And just if, because the online world is the Wild West, anything could happen. Anyone could get online. So it's just not going, oh yeah, my kid plays this totally age-appropriate game and that's it. No, it's just about, hey, what have you been playing? Who have you been playing with? Tell me more about the game. And it actually would be amazing for a kid going like, oh, my parent really wants to know more about this life. And it's just as if I was, I don't know, collecting flowers outside. I could show my parent like, hey, mom, look at these flowers I've collected in Skyrim and they look amazing. And it's something that I find something beautiful. Why can't I share that with my parent without feeling like, oh, that's just a video game. That's stupid. No. So the advice for parents, it's not be a guard. Be curious, play with them, see what they're playing, try to understand what excites them so much about these things.
I think that's a really good advice, because I think it's about, the parents that I have seen, it's about, well, you're playing too many video games, you cut off your screen time. So it's a very kind of not so much disciplinary, but it's a very harsh engagement with their child when it comes to gaming, rather than a curiousness of what are you playing? Oh, tell me about it. What about the friends? So what is this game all about? It's not about drawing the child into a space of tell me. It's almost like saying, well, tell me about your football game and tell me about your friends. Exactly. And tell me about, so it's in a similar way, you kind of be curious about what they're doing online rather than it being a strict This is a no-go zone. You shouldn't be doing this. This is really bad for you. So we're going to cut it off because you can't stop playing. So you must be addicted.
Play 2 hours. Yeah.
Exactly. And there is it. And I think with parents, one of the things I don't often understand is that if you, well, two things. The one, if they are coming into the room and saying, well, actually, it's time for you to stop playing. And those, if someone is trying to befriend a child who is a lot older than the child and trying to groom them, that groomer will start becoming aware of the routines of the children or routines of the family. So therefore will stop talking potentially around the time that the parents could come in. So the parents have no idea what's going on. But the second thing is that, especially more relevant for most people, is that you can't just stop playing an online multiplayer game.
Yes, I think that's very important because, well, in our time, online gaming wasn't like it is now. We had games that we stopped, we'd press the button, it would stop forever until you press the button again. So I guess parents are always like, oh, you need to stop playing right now, because they think, oh, you just got to pause it. Everything can be possible for a parent. And in reality, as you said, you're in the middle of a match, you're in the middle of a raid where everything has a task, and the kid cannot be like, okay, goodbye, team. Even though we've been working on this for 3 hours, we cannot finish it because I have to go right now. No. It's about, yeah, speaking with them like, oh, are you going to take long? Yes, I'm finishing this raid. Great. Dinner is ready in 30 minutes. Be there.
Yeah. And I think most people understand that if they're part of a team. You've got a life outside of the game, and it's part of just letting them know that actually I need to finish up in half an hour because I'm not going to be available. So there's a time limit. So one thing I want to ask you, because there's a real perception and probably a misperception of that the majority of gamers are boys and girls don't play video games, and you are proof positive, as is Chelsea, actually, who's been on the podcast as well, that girls play video games and they really get involved and they really engage in video games. What is the kind of general proportion of boys versus girls who play online video games?
Well, yes, it tends to be seen as boys. Boys are the ones that are playing, males, it's just a male-dominated space. It's really not. It's a very common perception, but it's one of the biggest myths in the entertainment industry, I would think. The gender split is actually very close. Like, it's not 50-50, but it's very close. I think in the most recent Entertainment Software Association, the ESA, that's like every year puts out some data on how people are playing. It was 47% of video game players identify as a female in the US.
No way.
It's like 50-50, but almost.
Wow. That's incredible. Wow.
Yes. And it's not like, oh, it's just this year or the previous. No, it's in the previous years. We've seen similar numbers in other global reports. It's usually 45 to 48% of the gamer population. It's a women, they're female. So it's nearly half of all players are women. So definitely the stereotype is not supported by the data.
Yeah, nice. Girl power.
I think what happens in that case is that there are certain games that are like male players are drawn to, like more competitive action or strategy games, and those games tend to do better. While female games are often kind of drawn to simulation or puzzle or role-playing games, but a player is a player, whether they're playing Call of Duty or Animal Crossing, it doesn't matter.
And there's also been some kind of reports around girls being bullied and sidelined by boys when they're engaging in online games. Have you found this to be the case? And if a female playing a video game is, or girl playing a video game is sidelined, is there any kind of advice you'd give them?
So, yes, this is the case. Clearly, females are always going to be bullied. Well, not always. I hope not always. But right now, as the space, as it exists, the girls, the female populations are getting online bullied. It's awful. As a female player, this is a very real problem. And for instance, let's say I really like competitive games and first-person shooters. If I'm playing first-person shooters and I dare to use my microphone, it's gonna be the worst. The worst. It's frustrating. It's annoying. People start shooting me. Like, my own teammates start shooting me just because they realized from my mic that I was a female.
Oh, no way.
And when I'm like, but why? Like, that match hasn't even started. This is on a game called Rainbow Six Siege, where you have, like, some preparation time. And in this preparation time, I was like, okay, great, let's take the kitchen. Boom, shot in the back. It's like, why would you shoot me? We are a team. Go back to the kitchen. It's like, oh, my Lord.
Yeah. Okay.
Yes. So as for tools or what can a female do in this space, honestly, it's just about using the tools that the game gives you. This is the first line of defense. So if I keep getting shot by my one specific teammate, okay, I'm just going to record this guy. I'm going to mute them. I'm going to block them. I'm going to do anything in my power to make sure that the game maker is aware that this person is not very sports-like. I can't do anything besides that if I start to address the bully, like, oh, why would you say that? It's just worse. So it's just muting them, blocking them. Fine, they're going to kill me in this match. I'm just going to quit the match, find a new match, and stay quiet. It is also about playing with people you know. There's plenty of, like, online groups that you can find that are just for females, that are just for LGBT groups. The communities are there because we know that gaming can be very, very violent, it can be threatening at some points. So it's just about finding the appropriate people to play or like to play with. You are not obligated to listen to anyone's toxicity when you're online. So if it gets too much, fine. Quit the game, start it again. It sucks. It's awful. But unfortunately, we live with these people. So yeah, I think the best long-term solution would be playing with people you know. That doesn't have to be people that you know in real life, but finding this type of online communities. The female, there's a girl gamers community where we do not accept males on our ranks because, yes, it's annoying. There's also the gay gamers, where it's all about the LGBTQ gamers. And it's about finding your community and playing with them instead of playing with people trying to find your community. That could be very, very hard.
Yeah, because it's almost like finding friends when you're at school or at work. It's people who you engage with and you feel comfortable with and who support you in whatever you do, and people that you can form a team with. So, and if you don't kind of put yourself into a team where they're just going to bully you, you go find a team where they'll support you. So you wouldn't do it in the outside world or kind of in playing any other sports. So you just do the same thing in the online world and you avoid teams where they will push you around and bully you.
I
suppose because there's an online disinhibition effect, which is really they are anonymous and you can't, there's not kind of any social, physical
ties. What's the word? Like, yeah.
Yeah. So they're not going to be found out and told off by someone in the physical world. So they can kind of come out and show their prejudices in an online world where no one knows them physically. Which can be really intimidating, I guess, for so many people. So it's finding your
many
team.
Actually don't care. Like, my partner plays video games. She plays with people she knows, but she doesn't have an issue using the mic, having people going like, oh, go to the kitchen. She enjoys it because she plays better than them.
Oh, nice.
So she enjoys the hate messages like, oh, go back to the kitchen. It's just like, well, they're just salty because I was better than them. And I think that's just it. The space is there for anyone. We have to enjoy it how we can. Like, we belong here just because there are stupid people that want to put down some other people doesn't mean we have to stay away from these spaces.
Exactly that. So now you currently work with a customer experience analyst for a gambling company. So what does a customer experience analyst do, and how does your cyber psychology experience help you in the role?
CX analyst is a customer experience analyst, as you mentioned before. And a customer experience analyst in general means I'm studying the entire journey that a customer has within a company or within a product. And this is digital products or, well, digital companies, as you said, as you mentioned. I work for an online gambling company. And I think my experience as a cyber psychologist became very relevant in here. How do I explain it? It wasn't that they were looking for a cyber psychologist, but the skills I had from my cyber psychology, from my research, were completely relevant. So, for instance, my research, as we discussed before, it focused on the nuances of gaming behaviors and the impact of well-being. So it gave me like a unique lens on this kind of problem, because I'm seeing people that are online gambling, which is could also be online gaming, in a different perspective. I think they really enjoyed that, and that's why they hired me, but who knows? Like, having that academic background, it provides like a deep understanding of the distinction between the users that are deeply engaged or like highly engaged with the online gambling, and the users that are just playing passionately, or the users that are kind of experiencing some type of behavior problems that could be problematic. Since my research was in gaming and gambling have been analyzed sometimes by the same lens. So I think that my experience looking at, okay, gaming is not super bad all the time, gaming can be useful, helped me in analyzing these users and going, okay, they're not just gamblers that are losing their money. Some people are playing for fun, some people are playing because they run into money and they don't know what else to do, and some people could have problematic behaviors that my academic research made me very aware of. So I'm happy to understand, like, okay, this person is experiencing or displaying or saying some comments that could be problematic. So I think that's a very positive thing from my research that has helped me in this job.
Someone that I recently spoke to, and I've kind of talked about this quite often in other interviews that I've had with, or other chats I've had with people, is that every company or every technology company should have a cyber psychologist in the team. Do you think that is the case, that cyber psychology really needs to be a fundamental part of technology companies?
I think so. I completely agree. There should be always someone looking into how the user is experiencing with the digital products, because it's not about how we can make a product more successful, how we can make the user spend more money. It's about how is the user reacting? Are we paying attention to the user? Is everything okay? Like, specifically in my industry, it's online gambling, is something, because which is still very stigmatized in many places. So it's about paying attention to the customer, not to get more money from them. It's to see how are they using the environment? How are we using the platform? Do they need help that maybe they haven't been able to ask? It's about recognizing these patterns. And I think like having someone that's an expert of recognizing these patterns, it's incredibly valuable in any digital space where the user's well-being is a priority, because it shows more like a proactive and empathetic approach, like helping to ensure that the environment is not only engaged, it's not only engaging, but it's also safe, it's supportive, it's responsible. And I think that's what we should be striving for. Like, technology is going to keep evolving, and we should be trying to make it as safe and as responsible and as ethically, morally right as we can.
Yeah, absolutely agree. Camilla, what is the most important question I haven't asked you yet?
So I think a really important question to ask, since we were talking about gaming, it's about the share of responsibility. Like, where does the duty of care lie for creating a healthier gaming ecosystem? Does it lie with the players, like we were talking before, like taking the precautions as a female player, like to enjoy these experiences? Does the duty of care lie with the producers, the designers? Like, can they do something within the game based on psychological principles that directly shape the player behavior? I think it's an interesting question, because it's a very ethical component to designing games that are not just engaging, and as we were saying, that also support the overall well-being. It's not about making it the most addictive game possible. It's about making sure the user's enjoying it and the user's well-being, it's overall okay. So I think that would be a very important question. Where does it lie? Is it the companies? Is it the designers? Is it more digital literacy for players? Like, maybe we need to empower users, especially young players, to be like critical, to be informed consumers, teach them how to manage their own like playing habits, how to recognize and deal with toxic behavior online. So who would we kind of blame for this? Is it something that we all need to do together, which is, I think, the better approach, everyone working together? Because especially now, like with the rise of AI, it's going to be so hard to keep the the young informed in a digital way, because there's so many fake things coming up and AI videos, AI images, AI scams. I think my generation was very fortunate that we grew up with these things still forming up, so we can recognize, oh, that's completely fake. But the new generations that have grown up with this, that are completely normal, are developing on this, I think we need to definitely give them some more digital or online education or knowledge, so they can explore this online world that is only going to get bigger, being safe.
I think you're right. I think it's everyone's responsibility, because a lot of parents say, well, it's the government's responsibility, or it's the big tech responsibility. And as do educational institutions, have said, well, it's not our responsibility, it's someone else's. So there's a lot of people saying, well, it's not our responsibility, but actually it's everyone's responsibility. Digital literacy is everyone's. Everyone needs to learn their own digital literacy, but also train others. And it's so urgent now, as you say, because of generative AI. And it's going to really impact us unless we kind of really take on board the whole, take up the flag and play this game together. Okay, so Camilla, what do you think the future of cyber psychology looks like, especially in kind of your area in terms of gaming or gambling and that kind of thing? Where do you see cyber psychology going?
Well, I think that's a great question, and I could build on what I was talking before about shared responsibility. I think the future of cyber psychology needs to look into more of a shift from being reactive and to more where we're often studying problems after they appeared, to a switch or a view in which we're more proactive or preventative, so to speak. So I think the main area we should be talking about is developing like a framework, we could be calling like a digital, well, it's digital literacy. It's like digital nutrition. It's like with food. We need to help people understand what the psychological ingredients of their digital life are. So we should be asking, is this app designed for mindful use, or is this used for compulsive scrolling? Does this game foster genuine connection, or does it make you isolate yourself? So it's about not taking what it's already out and going, oh, this is how we need to adapt, but going, this is what we have. This is how we can start training people about this is what the digital world is. And if you think it's crazy right now, it's only going to get crazier. So you need to be completely aware of what you're doing online. You need to be, kind of aware of what you're eating. It's like if you're eating lunch, you need to have your carbohydrates and your proteins in this, and the digital world and cyber psychology, I think it would be the same. And in this proactive mindset, for instance, in gaming opportunities or in gaming in VR or the metaverse, as some people call it, it means working with designers to build worlds that are ethically designed to support well-being from the start, that are not just a game that a 7-year-old is going to put on a headset on and then completely forget the world, forget to eat, forget their social lives. In social media, for instance, it means focusing on designs that promote genuine connection over comparison, over negativity. And well, as I said, when our rapidly evolving relationship with AI is proactively shaping the partnerships with AI to be ethical, it's teaching the people the digital literacy skills to navigate wisely among the online interactions or among the online world. I think that's what cyber psychology should work into, just being more proactive. I think technology is advancing at an incredible rate, and we're going to see amazing things during our lifetime. And if people aren't informed of what does it mean, if this app is actually making me better because I can track my food, or is actually giving me more body issues because it's comparing my BMI with all my friends and things like that.
I love that digital nutrition, because I think that's a really good way to look at it. It's kind of because we are feeding our brains and in a lot of ways. And it's kind of a digital nutrition rather than just digital literacy, because digital literacy sounds like hard work.
Yeah.
But digital nutrition sounds like a fundamental thing we really need to survive well.
Absolutely.
I think there's a blog post in that one.
Interesting.
Exactly. Do you have any particular favorite cyber psychology book that you'd kind of recommend to others, especially around the world of gaming?
Oh, especially about the world of gaming. I mean, I could recommend the book that started it all for me and like yes. made me realize I wasn't alone in this endeavor of finding the positive things about gaming. And it's very aptly named, Video Games and Wellbeing.
Oh, nice one.
That is a great book, and it's basically uses research from not only psychology, but also fields like education and media studies to show how gameplay can teach skills, like as we were saying before, resilience, flexible thinking, a growth mindset, all of the benefits we mentioned before, but just like cemented in more like academic research. It is a fantastic book. I loved it. But I would actually recommend a different book now that I think of it.
Okay.
It would be The Video Game Debate by Rachel Coward. Okay. And Thorsten Quandt. Yes, it's a great evidence-based book. It looks at the big topics in gaming. It's not just the benefits or the negatives. It's about the big topics. So violence, addiction. And I think it does a great job in separating the facts from the moral panic itself. I believe their way of explaining the things are really straight to the point. Well, I really love the way Dr. Kortz explained things. She has a great YouTube channel, Zeitgeist, which is a series looking into psychology behind video games. There are books, there are videos. Oh, so I could recommend that as a channel. So video... The book, Video Game Debate 2, and the channel, it would be Zeitgeist from Dr. Coward.
That's, that would be a really good book for parents to read to kind of help them understand more about why video games actually can be really beneficial. So thank you for that recommendation.
Absolutely.
Cool. Camilla, thank you so much for joining me on Confessions of a Cyber Psychologist. It was so lovely to have you on board, and I really look forward to chatting to you again in the future.
I look forward to chatting with you in the future as well, Caroline.